November 7th, 1997. New York City. 54-year-old Michael Sullivan and his 36-year-old girlfriend Camden Sylvia vanished without explanation from their loft in Manhattan and are reported missing 6 days later. Suspicion falls upon the couple's landlord, Robert Rodriguez, who was involved in a dispute with them prior to their disappearances and refuses to cooperate with the investigation. It turns out that Rodriguez is connected to the unsolved disappearance of another man which took place 6 years earlier, and even though he eventually serves time in prison on fraud charges, there are no answers about what happened to Michael and Camden. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be exploring a bizarre missing persons case about a couple from New York City. The 1997 disappearances of Michael Sullivan and Camden Sylvia. Michael and Camden were living together in a loft in Manhattan until they seemingly vanished into thin air, but on the same day they went missing, they presented a letter to their landlord, Robert Rodriguez, announcing their intention to go on a rent strike unless he provided adequate heating in the building. Well, when police started investigating Rodriguez, he would suddenly disappear himself for 10 days, but by the time he resurfaced, he had hired an attorney and would no longer cooperate with the investigation. Rodriguez would eventually go to prison on unrelated charges, and it turned out that a former business associate of his named David King vanished without explanation years earlier, and he has also never been found. Now, while it's easy to assume the worst about Rodriguez, there is zero evidence that foul play took place, or that he could have been responsible for the disappearances of Michael and Camden. There are just so many unanswered questions about the last time the couple was confirmed to be alive, potential motives for their disappearance, and the logistics of getting rid of their bodies. It's a very puzzling case, but we're going to explore all the different angles on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or a review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the disappearances of Michael Sullivan and Camden Sylvia. Our story begins in New York City in 1997. Our central figures are 54-year-old Michael Sullivan and his 36-year-old girlfriend Camden Sylvia, who both share a 1,400-square-foot loft on the top floor of a five-story apartment building located at 76 Pearl Street in Manhattan. While Michael is a native New Yorker who has lived in this apartment since 1976, Camden originally hails from the village of Hyannis in the Cape Cod region of Massachusetts. After making the move to New York, Camden got a job at a Manhattan real estate office, which has been her place of employment for the past 14 years, and she also works as a painter on the side. Michael's primary occupation is working as an admissions clerk at the New Museum of Contemporary Art, though he also works as an actor, dancer, and choreographer. After Camden became involved in a relationship with Michael, she decided to move in with him, and they have lived together in this loft for 5 years at this point. The actual date of the couple's disappearance was Friday, November the 7th, and while there are contradictory details about when they were last seen, it sounds like the final confirmed sighting took place when they stopped by a video store named City Hall to rent a VHS tape of the romantic comedy Addicted to Love. Over the course of the weekend, some of the couple's friends and relatives attempted to phone Michael and Camden at their apartment, but could not reach them and never heard back. Camden never showed up to work at a real estate office, and by Tuesday, November the 11th, one of her co-workers had become concerned that Camden did not at least attempt a call to check her messages. The co-worker started contacting Camden's family in Cape Cod to see if they had heard from her, and word eventually reached Camden's mother, Lori Sylvia, who was in Washington, D.C. on a business trip. Once Lori heard about what was going on, she decided to travel to Manhattan and stop by her daughter's apartment building on Thursday, November the 13th. Camden and Michael were not there, but most of their clothing and personal belongings had been left behind in the loft, including both of their passports and Michael's wallet. The VHS tape for the movie Addicted to Love was also found in the apartment, along with a timestamp receipt, which indicated that the couple had returned home after renting it. While one set of the couple's apartment keys was missing, the other set was still there, so it seemed likely that Camden and Michael had left together at some point. The only other items that appeared to be missing were a bag that Camden normally carried when she took work home from the office, as well as two pairs of running shoes, which led to speculation that they might have gone out jogging. This compelled Lori to contact the New York Police Department to officially report Camden and Michael missing. A search of the couple's financial records showed that their credit cards had not been used since November the 7th, and there was no paper trail for them at all since that date. On Saturday, November the 15th, investigators phoned the building's landlord, a 56-year-old Cuban immigrant named Robert Rodriguez, at his residence. Rodriguez was married with three children and three grandchildren, and after purchasing the building in 1993, he opened up his own locksmith shop on the ground floor. At this point, he lived outside New York City on a 7-acre estate located in Orange County in the hamlet of Slate Hill. Rodriguez was initially very cooperative with investigators and said that he would arrange for someone to provide them with keys to the building so they could perform a search. The following afternoon, investigators phoned the Rodriguez residence again to ask if he would come down to the precinct for a formal interview. To their surprise, Rodriguez's family informed them that at around midnight the previous evening, shortly after their original phone call with him, he left the residence in his Honda Passport after saying that he needed to go meet the police for an interview. By the time investigators called to arrange a real interview, Rodriguez had still not returned home, so his family filed a missing persons report with the New York State Police. 1 week later, Rodriguez's abandoned Honda Passport would be discovered inside a parking garage in Chelsea, and the timestamp ticket would show that it originally pulled in there at 2:37 a.m. on November the 16th, only a few hours after he left his residence. During Rodriguez's absence, police wanted to perform a search of his house and property, but his family refused to give them permission to do so. Police countered by flying a helicopter over the property and using infrared devices to search for any bodies that might have been buried on freshly dug land, but they found no evidence that could be used as probable cause to obtain a search warrant. After being missing for 10 days, Rodriguez finally resurfaced when he suddenly showed up at his locksmith shop at the apartment building. However, by this point, Rodriguez had hired an attorney and was no longer cooperating with the investigation. It turned out that on the morning of November the 7th, hours before she disappeared, Camden had been seen heading towards Rodriguez's locksmith shop with the intent of presenting him with a signed letter. One of the couple's neighbors was a photographer named Chuck Delaney, who was the building's tenant representative on the New York City Loft Board. According to Delaney, ever since Rodriguez purchased the building, there were always issues with him not turning up the heat at the beginning of the winter season. Since Camden and Michael lived in a drafty, uninsulated loft on the top floor, the issue affected them more than any of the other tenants, and since this particular year had a much colder November than usual, they decided to take action. The couple put together a letter for Rodriguez, signed by themselves and some of the other tenants, in which they announced their intention to go on a rent strike and seek enforcement from the New York City Heat Complaint Bureau and the New York City Loft Board, unless Rodriguez ensured that the building was properly heated. Camden also had a second letter containing a demand for Rodriguez to install a thermostat in her apartment. There was additional tension over the fact that the building was rent-controlled and Michael had lived in his loft for 21 years. As a result, the couple's rent was only $304 per month, but if they were to leave and a new tenant moved into the apartment, Rodriguez would be able to charge them 10 times that amount, as the market rate for renting a 1,400-square-foot loft in Manhattan during that time period was around $3,000 per month. While Camden and Michael were missing, Lori Sylvia held frequent candlelight vigils for the missing couple at the building, alongside their friends and fellow tenants. To prevent Rodriguez from renting out the loft in their absence, Lori sent him a money order for $304 to pay the rent on their behalf. In response, Rodriguez's attorney stated that he would not be accepting payments from anyone besides the original tenants, though he offered his assurances that he would not rent out the loft until there were conclusive answers about what happened to them. Over the course of the next few years, police would perform numerous searches of bodies of water in the area, including the Hudson River, but never found any trace of the couple. Sometimes, a body or a severed body part, such as a foot, would surface in these waters, but DNA testing would always rule out the possibility that they belonged to Michael or Camden. Well, believe it or not, this was not the only unsolved missing persons case from New York City which Rodriguez was connected to. On January the 22nd, 1991, David King, a 31-year-old African-American man who lived with his wife and two children in the Flatbush neighborhood of Brooklyn, was last seen leaving his residence to head to his job at FireSafe Alarm Systems in Lower Manhattan, but he never returned home and was subsequently reported missing months later. Well, the owner of FireSafe Alarm Systems was none other than Robert Rodriguez, and it was originally a lock and security business before Rodriguez decided to expand his operation by servicing fire alarms. One of Rodriguez's employees was David King, who had previously worked as a fire alarm technician for a competing company called Multiplex Electrical Services, aka MES. Well, at the time King went missing, he, Rodriguez, and another former MES employee named Derek Brickhouse were listed as co-defendants in a $13 million civil lawsuit from MES, who alleged that the defendants had conspired to loot computer software, business records, and customer information from their company. With Brickhouse's assistance, King had supposedly spent the better part of 6 months supplying Rodriguez with confidential materials from MES while he was employed there. When the company fired King in January of 1990, Rodriguez hired him to work at FireSafe Alarm Systems and was apparently planning to make him his business partner. However, it does not sound like this arrangement ever came to fruition, and shortly before he vanished, King had reportedly been seen having an argument with Rodriguez about the situation. At this point, MES's lawsuit was heading towards litigation, but King's disappearance delayed the proceedings until a judgment was eventually issued against him, and he was ordered to pay over $91,000 in damages to MES. The company agreed to drop the lawsuit against Rodriguez and Derek Brickhouse in exchange for a guarantee that Rodriguez would return all the software and confidential information King had provided to him and not perform work at any buildings which use MES's fire alarm systems. For years, police never performed any sort of investigation into King's disappearance, figuring that he might have run away to avoid his legal troubles, but the disappearances of Michael and Camden prompted them to give King's case a second look. In December of 1997, investigators announced that they were planning to exhume an unidentified John Doe who had been buried in the city's Potter's Field on Hart Island. After searching through hundreds of missing persons cases and medical examiner's files, they came across a report for an African-American male who had washed ashore from the East River on March the 8th, 1991, less than 2 months after David King originally went missing. His cause of death was determined to be drowning, and he apparently bore a striking resemblance to King in his morgue photographs, but no dental records or x-rays could be found for King to compare him to the John Doe. I know some sources state that investigators attempted to perform DNA testing, but members of King's family refused to provide samples of their blood so the testing could take place. But I've also read another article from the New York Times in January of 1999, which states that the DNA testing was inconclusive. Either way, it does not look like it was ever proven that King was the John Doe, and he is still listed as missing to this day. Of course, Rodriguez was looked at as a potential suspect in King's disappearance, but no evidence was ever found to implicate him. However, Rodriguez's connection to the disappearances of Michael Sullivan and Camden Sylvia prompted investigators to perform a deep dive into his background, and the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and a federal grand jury would eventually subpoena financial records from his locksmith shop. It turned out that Rodriguez had purchased the apartment building with insurance money he had been awarded when the original house on his property in Orange County burned down. While investigators concluded that the fire was likely arson, they were never able to figure out who started it. At the time Michael and Camden went missing, Rodriguez was suffering from a number of financial problems, as he owed over $32,000 in back taxes on the apartment building, and his locksmith shop seemed to be the only thing which was keeping the building afloat. Well, the investigation into Rodriguez's financial history turned up a ton of illegal activity, and in January of 1991, he was arrested on state and federal charges for such crimes as larceny, tax fraud, and credit card fraud. One of his scams involved using the social security number and birth date of a deceased man named Alan Rodriguez, who was of no relation to him, in order to open up credit card accounts and purchase a number of items which he never paid for. Rodriguez had also spent years laundering around $1.3 million in income from his locksmith shop and his side security business in order to avoid paying taxes on them. Following his arrest, the police finally performed a search of his house and property in Orange County, but found nothing, and Rodriguez's wife would subsequently divorce him and sell their house. Rodriguez decided to sell his apartment building, and the new owners finally gave police permission to search it. They used cadaver-sniffing dogs and tore up the flooring in Rodriguez's locksmith shop, but were unable to find any evidence which shed light on what happened to Michael and Camden. Following the building's acquisition, the new owners served Lori Sylvia with an eviction notice for her daughter's loft. Even though Lori attempted to fight this in court, the ruling was that since Camden and Michael were presumed dead, they were no longer protected by rent stabilization, so their loft would be rented out to a new tenant at the current market rate. In October of 1999, Rodriguez pled guilty to tax and credit card fraud, and as part of a plea agreement, he would receive a prison sentence of 2 to 6 years. Less than 2 years later, Rodriguez managed to attain parole and was scheduled to be released from prison on August the 30th, 2002, but this decision was met with considerable backlash from law enforcement officials and the families of Michael and Camden, as their names were not mentioned at all during Rodriguez's parole hearing. In response, the New York State Parole Board decided to re-interview Rodriguez and asked him about a cache of licensed guns he owned. One of the conditions of his early release would be to turn in these guns, but Rodriguez claimed he could not account for them, and the parole board described him as being quote-unquote evasive and intentionally deceitful in his answers, as he even evoked his Fifth Amendment privilege at one point and declined to answer any questions to avoid self-incrimination. This prompted the board to reverse their decision about Rodriguez's early parole, and he would be forced to serve out his full sentence before he was finally released in August of 2004. Rodriguez subsequently moved to East Harlem and has continued to deny any involvement in the disappearances of Michael Sullivan and Camden Sylvia, and after nearly 24 years, they both continue to remain missing persons. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So this is an unsolved mystery which seems to be based around a very identifiable situation, as I'm sure that most of us have been through an experience in which we've had a dispute with a landlord. But it's not often that a situation like this could escalate to the point where it potentially leads to murder. Even though this case does have a very promising potential suspect in Robert Rodriguez, it's worth noting that law enforcement has never officially named him as a suspect in the disappearances of Michael Sullivan and Camden Sylvia, and there's a very good reason for that. While there is definitely some suspicious behavior on Rodriguez's part, there is no evidence here that a crime has even been committed, let alone that Rodriguez harmed these two missing individuals. If he was responsible for this, he did a very thorough job at covering his tracks. We do know that on the day that Michael and Camden went missing, Rodriguez had been presented with a signed letter in which they and a number of the other tenants announced their intention to go on a rent strike unless he provided them with adequate heating for their apartments. But I'd hardly call that a strong motive to commit murder, as it sounds like this issue popped up every single year, since Rodriguez was known for taking his sweet time to heat up the building at the start of the winter season. Even if you're a major penny pincher trying to save money by any means possible, It seems like quite an overreaction to decide you're going to kill two people rather than simply turn on the furnace. But even if you put aside the why for Rodriguez committing this crime, the how, when, and where are complete head-scratchers. Theoretically, let's just say that there was some sort of confrontation which escalated into murder. If this took place inside the apartment building, not only would Rodriguez have to kill two people, but he would have to do so in a fashion which didn't attract the attention of any of the other tenants, as I don't believe they ever reported seeing or hearing anything unusual that day. He would then somehow have to get their bodies out of the building and dispose of them, but it's very difficult to be inconspicuous about something like that in downtown Manhattan. I think another issue with figuring out what happened here is that it's really hard to pin down the last time Michael and Camden were confirmed to be alive. Some sources, like the victim's profile pages on the Charlie Project, make it sound like they left their apartment to go jogging, which is something they frequently did. If they managed to exit the building and jog somewhere, then they could have crossed paths with an unknown third party besides Rodriguez, who proceeded to abduct and murder them. But from what I've read in most of the news articles about this case, it was only theorized that they went jogging because their running shoes were missing from the apartment. As far as I can tell, I don't believe there were any eyewitnesses who could actually confirm having seen them out jogging that day, which would mean that the last verified sighting of the couple was when they rented out the movie Addicted to Love from a video store. Since the VHS tape was found inside the apartment, they obviously returned there at some point, and given that one set of keys and Michael's wallet were also left behind, it seems likely that the couple left together but weren't planning to be out that long. So the big question is, did they cross paths with Rodriguez and have some sort of confrontation with them before they exited the building? Well, searches of the building failed to turn up any evidence of foul play, but the problem is that it was 6 days before the couple were actually reported missing, so Rodriguez would have had ample time to cover his tracks. Now, according to Camden's mother, Lori Sylvia, when she first met Rodriguez, he couldn't have been any nicer to her, as he gave Lori a new set of keys for the apartment and said, "Let me know if there's anything else I can do to help." So at the very least, this suggests Rodriguez was not too concerned about Lori finding anything incriminating inside the loft. It sounds like Rodriguez was very cooperative during the early stages of the investigation, but before he could be formally interviewed, he suddenly took off and disappeared for 10 days. However, did Rodriguez do this because he was involved in Michael and Camden's disappearances? Or was he paranoid that the police might find other skeletons in his closet? One ironic detail about Rodriguez is that he kept a newspaper about himself on the wall of his office because in 1984, there was an incident where he returned a lost $900,000 check to its rightful owner and was hailed as a hero by the press. But it seems like Rodriguez might have been overcompensating a little bit, considering the numerous acts of fraud he committed over the years. I think it says something that Rodriguez originally bought the building with insurance money he received from his house burning down. Yes, I guess they technically never proved that he committed arson and burned down the house himself, but when you're the type of person who uses the identity of a dead guy to obtain credit cards, I think it's safe to say that there's no limit to the type of scams you'll pull. And of course there's the fact that another person connected to him, David King, happened to go missing while they were both embroiled in a civil lawsuit. We'll talk more about David King in a little while, but regardless of whether or not Rodriguez was involved in his disappearance, the fact that he was allegedly using King to provide him with confidential information from a rival fire alarm company really says a lot about his character. So by the time Rodriguez resurfaced after disappearing for 10 days, he hired himself the services of an attorney named Michael Rosen, and this was a pretty prominent, high-priced lawyer, as Rosen had once represented Thomas Gambino of the infamous Gambino crime family. Since Rodriguez lied to his family about going in for a police interview before he took off, this suggests that he was incredibly paranoid about something, but was it because he had knowledge or involvement in the disappearances of Michael and Camden? Well, it's easy to take his actions as a sign of guilt, but Rodriguez had spent the past several years committing numerous acts of fraud. So even if he was completely innocent of any role in their disappearances, he might have feared that if the police started interviewing and investigating him, they were going to turn up his other financial indiscretions, which is why he panicked and got himself a lawyer. If this was Rodriguez's intention all along, then it really didn't do him any good, since it only provided further motivation for the authorities to look into his background, and that's when they uncovered evidence to arrest him on all those other charges and send him to prison. While it's undeniable that Rodriguez is a criminal, does this necessarily mean he's a murderer? If Michael and Camden had somehow uncovered evidence of Rodriguez's history of fraud, that might have given him a motive to kill them, but there's nothing to indicate they knew about it. Another potential motive which has been pushed forward is that Rodriguez wanted the couple out of the way so he could finally rent out their loft to someone for a much larger sum of money. I mean, even in 1997, paying a monthly rent of only $304 for a 1,400-square-foot loft in Manhattan is a pretty mind-blowing deal, so even if there were issues with the heating or Rodriguez in general, I can definitely understand why Michael and Camden would have wanted to hold on to this place. At the time, New York City had pretty strict rent control and stabilization laws, and since Michael had originally rented the place over 20 years later, he did not have to worry too much about inflation. We know that Rodriguez was suffering from financial problems and owed thousands of dollars of back taxes on the building, so yes, it would have been in his best interest to have Michael and Camden out of the loft so that he could rent it out to a new tenant at around $3,000 per month. That might seem like a compelling motive, but the problem is that Rodriguez really didn't gain anything from the couple's absence in the long run. I know that until Rodriguez's arrest, there was a dispute between him and Lori Sylvia because she wanted to pay the $304 monthly rent to hold on to the loft, but he refused to accept the money. Rodriguez's attorney did make a public statement that he had no intention of renting out the loft while Michael and Camden were missing, but it's possible that Rodriguez was advised to do this for PR purposes in order to make himself look less suspicious. But the ironic thing is that the publicity surrounding the disappearances actually drew interest in the loft from a number of curiosity seekers who wanted to rent it. Rodriguez could have made himself a good chunk of money if he let this happen, but he never did, and the loft did not go on the market again until after Rodriguez was arrested and sold the building to new owners. So yes, Camden and Michael's disappearances did not financially benefit Rodriguez in any way. Until Rodriguez's arrest, I cannot imagine how awkward it must have been for the other residents of that building to be living with a landlord who was under suspicion for potentially causing the disappearances of two tenants. Even if they didn't believe he was guilty, how weird would it have felt to bring an issue to this guy's attention? I wonder if anyone complained about the heat the following winter. Now, I mentioned earlier that we cannot pinpoint the last time Michael and Camden were confirmed to be alive, and we can't even be 100% certain that they interacted with Rodriguez. According to their neighbor, Chuck Delaney, he did see Camden in the building that morning, and she told him she was heading to Rodriguez's locksmith shop to present him with the signed letter about the rent strike. We know that this letter did wind up in his office, but it's unclear if Camden just dropped it off there or if she interacted with Rodriguez. Since Rodriguez declined to discuss the case publicly, he never did confirm or deny if he spoke with her. The transaction at the video store confirms that Camden did visit other locations that day, and the primary theory which has been presented by her mother Lori is that after renting the video, Camden returned to the apartment, and both she and Michael decided to go out and confront Rodriguez together. This is when things could have gone horribly wrong, and they both wound up dead, but again, if Rodriguez committed murder inside the building, how did he manage to do so without attracting attention? And how did he dispose of the two bodies? So now we have to go back and explore the second unsolved missing persons case in this story, and that's the disappearance of David King. This case has gotten nowhere near as much publicity as the disappearances of Michael and Camden, and there's less evidence to suggest what happened. All we know is that King left his house in January of 1991 to go to work and subsequently disappeared, but no one even attempted to file a missing persons report until July the 17th of that year, when King's mother, Emma Taupin, learned from his wife and children that they had not seen him in nearly 6 months. Back in 1991, the New York Police Department had a policy that unless there was strong evidence that foul play had taken place or the victim had a serious medical or mental condition, they could not accept missing persons reports for anyone between the ages of 17 and 65. This policy has since been changed, but I think it was likely in place because New York City had an insanely high crime rate in 1991, so the police just did not have the resources to search for every missing person. And besides, Since King was a co-defendant in a $13 million civil lawsuit, it wasn't hard to imagine him running off on his own to escape his legal troubles, so his disappearance got zero media coverage at the time. Of course, once Robert Rodriguez got linked to another missing persons case 6 years later, King's case finally got a proper investigation, but Emma Toppin did not hesitate to publicly express her frustration that it took the disappearance of two white people for her black son to receive any attention. The information about King's disappearance is fairly limited, but it sounds like Rodriguez had promised him a partnership in his business after luring him away from his previous employer, and this had failed to materialize. The two men were reportedly seen having an argument a short time before King went missing, so it's easy to assume that Rodriguez might have been involved. In the long run, I guess King's disappearance did benefit Rodriguez and his potential culpability in the civil lawsuit, because even though King wound up being ordered to pay $91,000 in damages, Rodriguez pretty much got off scot-free by pinky swearing he would not use any of the confidential information King gave him for his own gain. I guess technically, they could not prove that Rodriguez knew King was providing him with material that was stolen, but if King had been around to provide testimony, things might have turned out differently, and perhaps Rodriguez would have had more liability. So this may have given Rodriguez a potential motive to make King disappear, but since no investigation was performed until after Rodriguez hired an attorney, he was never formally interviewed about his potential role in this case. Now, there has been some confusion about an unidentified John Doe who was found in the East River in 1991. He supposedly bore a striking resemblance to King, but it's unclear if DNA testing was ever performed. It's been reported that King's family refused to provide blood samples for DNA testing, but since his mother has always been an outspoken advocate for him, I find it hard to imagine her not cooperating about this. The last media coverage I've seen about King is an article from Newsday in August of 2004, and since it makes no mention of the John Doe, I can only assume he was not a match. Even though this decedent drowned, it sounds like they were unable to determine how exactly he died. So even if the man was King, that doesn't necessarily mean he was murdered. For all we know, King's death may have been an accident, or he may have been so overcome by the stress of the civil lawsuit that he decided to take his own life by jumping off a bridge into the East River. With so little information, it's tough to make a conclusive determination about what happened to King. All that being said, it still seems like quite a coincidence that Rodriguez would be linked to two otherwise unrelated missing persons cases. I think the key difference between them is that we know for a fact that Rodriguez and King colluded together to do unethical things, so King might have known some incriminating information which put his life in danger. And while we also know for a fact that Rodriguez was doing a ton of illegal things at the time Michael and Camden went missing, we don't know if they knew anything about it. But if the couple did learn something incriminating, and Rodriguez decided to get rid of them, how would these events have unfolded? Well, one detail about this case which I've always found interesting is this cache of licensed guns which Rodriguez supposedly owned and could not be accounted for. As you recall, Rodriguez was originally going to be paroled 2 years before his scheduled release date, but the parole board changed their minds when they questioned Rodriguez about these guns, and he was unable to provide conclusive answers about what happened to them. In fact, it's been reported that Rodriguez could have received a lighter sentence than 2 to 6 years if he had turned in these guns at the time he pled guilty, but he never did. Now, I think the only reason this questioning took place to begin with was because the board's decision to parole Rodriguez was met with considerable backlash, and they were probably looking for any loophole they could find to reverse their decision without admitting they had screwed up. Given that a number of years had passed, I guess it's possible that Rodriguez legitimately had no idea where the guns were, but he was apparently quite evasive with his answers, and to me, the biggest red flag is that he invoked his Fifth Amendment privilege to avoid self-incrimination. I mean, pleading the Fifth can be a necessary tactic when you're questioned under oath in a courtroom, but this is honestly the first time I've ever heard of anyone doing this at a parole hearing. Parole boards expect inmates to be honest and take accountability for their actions, but if you decline to answer questions on the grounds of self-incrimination, that comes across like you have something to hide, and pretty much guarantees you're not getting out of prison. So this makes me wonder, why did Rodriguez want to avoid talking about this cache of guns? In spite of his financial crimes, It doesn't sound like he had any known history of violence in his background, so could one of these guns have been used as a murder weapon? If he had shot someone and disposed of the gun, then it would be very difficult for him to explain what happened to it, and could account for why he elected to plead the Fifth. Even if this ruined his chances of parole, and meant he would have to serve 2 more years in prison for fraud, that's still preferable to spending the rest of your life in prison for murder. But I must provide a disclaimer that this detail about the guns is nothing more than pure speculation on my part, and I still have issues with the idea that Rodriguez could have shot Michael and Camden inside the apartment building without anybody hearing anything. We know that all of Rodriguez's financial crimes were eventually uncovered because he got himself in way over his head, so that's why you have to wonder if he was capable of getting away with the perfect murder without leaving any incriminating evidence behind. Anyway, I'm not sure of the exact whereabouts of Rodriguez today, but if he's still alive, he would be around 80 years old. If he really was responsible for these crimes, then the clock is ticking to find evidence against him. If, by chance, Rodriguez's main motivation for not cooperating with the investigation into Michael and Camden's disappearances was because he was afraid of his financial crimes being uncovered, well, that wound up happening anyway, and he served his time in prison. If he truly has nothing left to hide, then I wish he would finally cooperate and speak to the police about what he knows. But then again, even if he's innocent in this case, there may be things about the disappearance of David King which he does not want to discuss. As for Lori Sylvia, at the time her daughter went missing, she was an advocate for the disabled and would pretty much become the official advocate for Camden and Michael. This is not the only family tragedy Lori has experienced, as two of her uncles vanished when they were lost at sea during the 1950s, and in January of 2014, she lost her 48-year-old son Matthew when he passed away after a long battle with pancreatitis. Lori is also getting up there in years, so it would be nice if she finally received some answers about what happened to her daughter. So if you happen to have any information on the disappearances of Michael Sullivan and Camden Sylvia, as well as the unsolved disappearance of David King, please call the New York Police Department at 646-610-6914. That's 646-610-6914. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about the bizarre 1934 ransom kidnapping of June Robles, who was found alive inside a metal box in the desert, but her kidnappers were never caught, and there's been some debate about whether the whole thing might have been an elaborate hoax. I'm also going to be dropping the occasional exclusive bonus Patreon episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, and we recently released an episode in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed the unsolved disappearance of convenience store clerk Deborah Poe. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Carl I, Kathy U, Giovanni, Gail H, Magella O, Catherine K, Ellen H, and Jason M. Thank you all so much for your support. I'm also pleased to announce that The Trail Went Cold has been added to the lineup for Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to get a discount. So to receive a 10% discount off a standard badge, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. That's crimecon.com and the promo code is TRAIL. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music here on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.